Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone's on the take, the hood's filled with dirty blocks. How we gonna save the community? They worse than us. It's like a curse for us, police be the first to bust. Think about it, that recruit's a f***ing joke. For them, the evidence will vanish in a puff of smoke. I've been observing, I'll never be subservient. I guess you get what you deserve in this. From project hallways to courthouse always. Some prevail, most see jail, this happens always. Speed on, before you get peed on. All I need is more power, then I'ma put the squeeze on. I want more power, I'm gaining more truth. I'm gaining more respect cause I want more juice. The most influential men got influential friends, and I'ma put the squeeze on all of them. I watch y'all get fat, now I want my share. What you ain't got at all, then I want what's there. The most influential men got influential friends, and I'ma put the squeeze on all of them.
The following internet radio show, it's for mature audiences only. That means, boys and girls, you must be 18 years of age or older to listen.
There are very few people you will meet in life that don't want at least one of these five things. Wealth, fame, / recognition, career success, respect from their peers, and power. The challenge for most of us is, what is the proper way to achieve one or more of these five things? What principles and code of conduct should I adhere to if I am ambitious and driven to stand out in today's ever so competitive society? There are some that believe the end justifies the means. They believe that becoming successful in life is not necessarily about being a nice person who always exhibits exemplary character and integrity. No, not at all. Don't be naive. Some believe that if you want anything bad enough in life, you have to be shrewd, calculating, strategic. One such theorist and philosopher who could arguably be perceived as a modern-day version of legendary writer and political insider Niccolo Machiavelli would be my guest this evening. He has a number of books, including The Art of Seduction, The 33 Laws of War, The 48 Laws of Power, and his latest entry is a book he co-authored with superstar rapper Curtis Jackson, known to his many fans as 50 Cent. Who is this man who has attracted both admiration as well as controversy and criticism from his legions of book readers? His name is Robert Greene. And if your goal is to reach the highest heights of wealth, fame, career success, and power, then get out your pen and notepad this evening. Because tonight, Robert Greene is more than prepared to get up front and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Is this me? Alan Roger Curry of Mode 1 fame. Oh my God.
You're really good at this.
Yeah, I gotta ask you though, do you feel that black men have some type of unwritten obligation to date and bury someone in the race? You do?
I think they do. I think white people should date white people. I think black people should date black people.
Now, how did you come up with this idea to go to Italy with the women?
With the women, right. I just got so tired of hearing all my male friends talk about Brazil and how great Brazil is for them.
When I was growing up, I would go and hear about black women complaining about white women are stealing our men. Don't complain about your goods being stolen if you casually leave them on the front porch.
Have sex. Enjoy your life.
You know, men really want women to have standards. They really do. And I don't know how we got off of the mark there, but men do like classy women, and they want women to have standards.
I think you can be single and be very, very happy, and I think it's about taking the pressures off about being married.
I'm not saying that you should disrespect a woman. Never disrespect your woman, but the key is to not let her walk all over you.
Romantic love is very volatile. People don't realize it. And it is a drug. People don't realize it. Men and women do stupid things. Not all men, but sometimes you'll do stuff stupid.
I think it's a turn-on because just to see that person, just to enjoy themselves and just to watch them touching that person and making them feel good, I think that's kind of sexy, actually.
Yo, yo, mode one. This is Gerard McClendon from Chicago Tonight and the McClendon Report. Right now you're listening to Upfront and Straightforward with my good friend, Alan Roger Curry. Mode one, let the women know, fellas, what you're really thinking. Ha ha, Alan Roger Curry.
We all flossed out, up in the VIP, white teeth, platinum link on me. I got a little bit of cheese, all drinks on me, but mommy gotta do something, no drinks for free. What you think of me, what you think you see, when I spin big faces, thick bracelets, my watch and ring. When I park my car, it don't stop a thing, cause the rim's still turning and we burning cigarettes. With the sweets, the freaks just order armadillo, buy the model, find the model, and sex her if you can.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network, and I'm your host, Alan Roger Curry. And today is Thursday, October 8th, and tonight's show should be very, very interesting. Now, I think all of my interviews and discussions on my show, Upfront and Straightforward, are interesting. But I have certain shows where my guests tend to encourage and emphasize philosophies and principles that in many ways are diametrically opposed to my own. If you're familiar with my book, Mode 1, and Upfront and Straightforward, you know that I'm all about upfront, straightforward honesty. I'm totally against the idea of manipulative head games. Well, my guest this evening, to one degree or another, is actually in favor of manipulation. He tends to come from the school of the end justifies the means. So whether your behavior is ethical or unethical, as long as it achieves your desired objective, then you've been successful. So I tell you this right now. There's going to be portions of our conversation I'm sure will just be entertaining and informative, but there's other portions where I'm sure it's almost inevitable that he and I will get into somewhat of a philosophical debate with one another, because there's just some things that I disagree with in his book, but I'm sure he's going to stand by every principle that he's ever espoused in his books. But before I get that discussion started, I got disappointing news for my loyal and enthusiastic listeners. I know, don't throw the tomatoes just yet. Next week, I will not be on the air live. Okay, I felt a tomato come my way. Next week, I will not be on the air live because I will be traveling. So I won't be doing a show next week, but I will be back 2 weeks from tonight. 2 weeks from tonight, I will be back October 22nd. My guest on October 22nd will be a New York City socialite and fashion editor by the name of Ty Beauchamp. I don't know if you're familiar. Ladies will probably be more familiar with this if they watch a lot of cable TV. There's a reality show called Holiday, where two women switch cities. Like, say you have one woman who lives in New York and another woman lives in L.A. They would switch cities and then go out on dates with different men in that city. She was on that show, and she was referred to me by a former guest of mine. So I'm going to talk to her about her experience on Holiday, and also we're going to just talk about the general concept of long-distance dating, something I can very much relate to, long-distance dating. As always, I give much love to my chat room. I love all my listeners, but particularly I have a fondness for my chat room listeners. I got one of my most loyal book readers in the chat room, Akai. He's in the chat room as Akaisaurus. Well, I just call him Akai. Got my loyal friend, Adrian, who's always in the chat room as Diva362636. I got a number of guests. I got Honey Kiss in the chat room. I got my loyal listener, Hypert. Hypert is in the chat room. I got T. Reed in the chat room. T. Reed is in the chat room. I got Paul Morris in the chat room. I got my cousin, my ace, my cousin, J.P. Jones. He's in the chat room as J-Rock. J-Rock, got my other cousin. That's right, Christopher Curry from Detroit, Hype Style. Hey, somebody said that they had problems getting in my chat room. Ooh, I got to talk to Blog Talk Radio. They can't be messing with my chat room. I love my chat room. And other shout-outs would be the lovely, talented Tyler Collins. What's up, baby? My brother and ace confidant, Stephen Curry. Arthur Ball, my cousin in Maplewood, New Jersey. Philip Pulliam and his older brother, Irvin V. Pulliam III. That's funny, I mentioned EVP3. He and my brother were the first one who enlightened me to this book called The Prince years ago that was written by a century-old writer and political insider named Niccolo Machiavelli. And when I read that, I was like, wow. I mean, this guy, he was definitely about to end, justifies the means. But EVP3, and along with my older brother, Steven, they were the ones who first told me about that book. Another shout-out would be Mike Bennett, Daryl Chapman, Andre Lowe, David Germanico, Nohad, a.k.a. Metal Hayes, Vanessa Turner, Kathy Holloway Hill, Will Wavy, Chad Hunter, my Blog Talk Radio colleagues, Facebook buddies. I see Self-Guided is in the chat room. Self-Guided just came in. Alloway Sana just came in the chat room. I'm still getting feedback on my little blurb in Black Enterprise. I appreciate it. I get a few emails every day. I appreciate that. I'm on page 43, Black Enterprise, October issue. Check it out. Michael Vick is going to have his own documentary series. What do you think about that? On BT. What's up, Juicy, in the chat room? Michael Vick is going to have his own documentary TV series. Chicago Bears went crazy last Sunday. 48.9. It was Detroit, so I can't get too excited. But still, I love to see a 48-point production from them. Now, you know the big revelation last week. Matter of fact, a week ago tonight. I just heard about it right after my show last week. The big news was David Letterman got Mold 1 and admitted on his show that he has slept with a number of his employees over the last few years. A lot of people, they thought it was a joke, but it was real. I give him points, if nothing else, for his straightforward honesty about it. You know, he came right out and said that he slept with some of his female employees, and you know, he didn't ask for forgiveness or anything. He knows, you know, because he's a married man. I think, though, a lot of when he was sleeping with these women were before he got married, but nonetheless. So, you know, that's been talking the news. Hey, he's still funny. I still respect him as a TV show host. Now, of course, though, it does mess with his credibility. You know, anybody in media knows credibility is everything. It's just like me. I got a book out about upfront, straightforward honesty. So if it was ever come to light that I was just engaged in a series of blatant lies, I would just lose all credibility. And David Letterman tends to poke fun at people who commit adultery and do things similar to that. And so now, you know, it makes his credibility to one degree or another kind of shaky. But nonetheless, I think his fans are so loyal that he's going to be forgiven. And Chris Rock is creating some controversy. I've been getting emails from some sisters, from black women's sisters, saying they're going to boycott his movie. He got a movie out coming out called Good Hair, where he's going to talk about the whole history of black women and their hair. Now, you know, I was taught young, you don't talk about a sister's weight or you don't talk about sister's hair, because you just might just get slapped. And so, yeah, a lot of women, some people are looking forward to the movie. Other people are kind of saying boycott it. Some sisters up in arms. And finally, I was forwarded a link for an article. I always like to get articles related to dating and relationships or sex. Guess what I read this week? You ready? This might blow your mind now. This might blow your mind. I see you, Jay McFly, in the chat room. How you doing in the chat room? Who else just came in the chat room? I see SKB in the chat room. But guess what? This knowledge I gained from this article. It said that studies have shown that if you keep a woman sexually satisfied, she will remain, and her well-being will be enhanced, and she will maintain good health, a good attitude, and great well-being. I don't like to curse on my show. I was going to say N-O space S-H, you know the rest. They didn't need no scientists and whatever else to get together to figure that out. I would think, yes, if a woman is being sexually satisfied, she's just going to walk around with a smile on her face all day and all week. Who's going to, like, walk around frowning because they had good sex? I don't get that. Anyway, I will be right back to engage my guests for the evening in conversation. Don't go anywhere. I will be right back.
Hey, I'm Dangerously. And you may have read my short story, Till Death Do Us Part, in the New York Times best-selling anthology, Succulent, Chocolate Flavor 2, presented by Zane. Well, things get even hotter between the pages of Keep Your Panties Up and Your Skirt Down. Check it out at PantiesUpSkirtDown.com. And remember, keep it dangerous.
No one.
You're about to enter into the erotic zone with yours truly, Alan Roger Kerr, the king of verbal seduction. This is the Erotic Conversationalist.
This is Diana DeVoe, and you're listening to Alan Roger Curry, a.k.a. the king of verbal seduction, right here on the Erotic Conversationalist.
This is Layla Odom, and you're listening to Alan Roger Curry, a.k.a. the king of verbal seduction, right here on the Erotic Conversationalist.
This is Bella.
And this is Charlie.
And we're dancers from the legendary Score Strip Club in New York City. And you're listening to Alan Roger Curry, a.k.a. the king of verbal seduction, right here on the Erotic Conversationalist.
Episodes of the Erotic Conversationalist are available as a downloadable MP3 file from www.mode1.net. All right, I'm going to go with my next caller, area code 310-310. You are now up front and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry. What's your question or comment?
I used to date lots of women, both in high school and in college and in medical school, and people used to always ask me, you're not the best looking guy, you're not the richest guy out there, how are you getting all these women? And essentially, the answer is actually quite simple. It's essentially having the confidence and knowing what you want to do.
Oh, thank you, thank you, Master Alan.
Ooh, say that again.
Yes, Master Alan.
Oh, say that again.
Yes, sir, Master Alan.
I like that.
Hey, buddy, thank you so much for having me. That is easily the nicest introduction that I've ever had.
Single, lonely, confused, join me. I invite you to listen to the most informative and entertaining talk radio show on the internet for single men and single women looking to enhance their social lives, love lives, and or sex lives. Get on the phone right now and tell one or two of your single friends to listen to Upfront and Straightforward with yours truly, Alan Roger Curry, Thursday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, and 7 p.m. on the West Coast, right here on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network. We now return to Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry, right here on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network.
Welcome back. Welcome back to tonight's episode of Upfront and Straightforward. My guest for the evening was born and raised in Los Angeles, California, and he later attended the University of California, Berkeley, well-respected school. If you're familiar with colleges, Berkeley is one of the top-tier schools, and he also attended University of Wisconsin. He's worked as a journalist as well as a Hollywood screenwriter. My guest this evening speaks several languages and has lived in London, Paris, Barcelona. In 1995, he was involved in the planning and creation of an art school entitled Fabrica outside Venice, Italy. And that was there where he met a person named Juice Elfers, the New York book packager, and discussed with him his idea for a book on power and, I'm going to say the M word, manipulation. Book on Power and Manipulation, the Ultimate Modern Version of Machiavelli's The Prince, which I mentioned earlier. Green and Elfers became partners, and in 1998, The 48 Laws of Power was born. The book has been a national and international bestseller. It's been translated into 17 languages. In 2001, Green's second book, The Art of Seduction, is more than a sequel to The 48 Laws of Power. Is both a handbook on how to wield the ultimate form of power and a detailed look at the greatest seducers in history. The third book in his series is The 33 Strategies of War. That came out in 2006, and that offers a strategic look behind the movements of war and application to everyday life. In addition to having a strong following within the business world and a deep following in D.C., these books have been hailed from Brothers in the Hood. Brothers in the Hood, they love 48 Laws of Power. I know, because I talked to a few of them. They just snatched it up. So you got a lot of rappers who snatched it up, including Jay-Z and 50 Cent. And speaking of 50 Cent, his latest entry is entitled The 50th Law, which was co-authored with 50 Cent, which emphasizes the theme of being fearless on behalf of Upfront and Straightforward in the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network. Listeners, give it up for New York Times bestselling author Robert Greene. What is up, Mr. Greene?
Wow, that's quite an introduction. That was brilliant. Thank you so much. You'd be honored.
Oh, you're.
I don't know where I can go from there.
Well, hey, anybody who comes on my show, I like to give them a very hearty and enthusiastic welcome to my show. And you surely earned it with your best-selling books. Now, you know, my first question right off the bat.
Yeah.
Where's the 49th law? You got the 48 laws of power, and you got the 50th law. What's the 49th law?
Well, I don't really know. I don't know. I'll discover that at some point. You know, I never, after I wrote the 48 Laws of Power, I never envisioned that there would be a 50th law either. But after I met 50 Cent and we decided to kind of bring our two brains together and do a book, it seemed like a natural wedding to bring his name, 50, and the 48 Laws. And it just so happens that the book that we created, I consider sort of the ultimate law of power. So it's, you know, I don't know if it should be 50 or number 1 or 49 or whatever number, but that's where it's at. So someday I'll get to 49.
Okay, okay. Now speaking of 50, Curtis Jackson, his formal name, how did you two first make each other's acquaintance?
Well, he contacted me. As you mentioned, a lot of rappers were really into the 48 Laws. You know, the music business, there's nothing more manipulative and dangerous than the music business. I mean, he grew up on the streets, but nothing prepared him for the sharks in the music industry. And so he himself had found the book very helpful when he moved into, you know, when he scored his real first big contract at Interscope. And so based on that, he contacted me, just wanted to meet. And we discovered, this was in 06 when we met, we discovered that we had this really kind of interesting rapport. It wasn't just that we, you know, liked each other's work. We had a kind of a weird connection that sort of bridged all the differences between us. And so based on the fact that we felt comfortable with each other, we decided, you know, let's maybe do a book. And we kept the idea open, and basically that was sort of the starting point. But it was he that initiated the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, why do you think your book has resonated with so many? Like, I know Scarface resonated with a lot of brothers from the streets, you know, and they loved that character. Why do you think the 48 Laws of Power, beyond the music industry, has resonated with so many brothers?
Well, you know, it's a little harder for me to say. I've asked some of my black readers what if they could answer it for me, because I'm not really necessarily sure. But if I could hazard a theory, it would be, you know, the power game traditionally is something that white people have dominated in Western cultures for hundreds, thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And the laws that I talk about are sort of the things that people have been using, kings and queens and presidents and CEOs of companies. And, you know, as a lot of black people were entering the middle class in various different forms, they were very interested in these laws and how people had been operating. Most often they were on the wrong end, the bad end of these power games. And I think they appreciated the honesty of the book. I don't say this is what's right or wrong, because that's not the point. I'm just simply laying it out to everybody that this is what people in power do. And a lot of it's manipulative, a lot of it's deceptive. Not all of it's bad, but a portion of it is. And I think they really appreciated the honesty, and so this could really help them navigate a world that, you know, nobody really writes about. There's no real handbook out there that prepares you for all the wicked political games that people play in the business world, and political world, even in the art world. And, you know, I mean, I think there are other theories, but I think that's part of it, at least.
So, let me clarify here. You're saying that you, the author, Robert Greene, you don't necessarily endorse the idea of manipulating others, but you're just putting it out there that there are people who do.
Let me put it this way. I believe that everybody, every human being, has aggressive impulses. Aggressive energy, that we all want a degree of power in our life, a degree of control over our children, our spouses, the people we work with. We hate the feeling of being helpless. And so I think all of us, to some degree or another, actually do manipulate people, that we're just not honest about it. But there's the degree, you know, there's the degree of whether it's sort of kind of harmless stuff that we do just to get by, or it's the major George W. Bush type of manipulation. And so I'm not, you know, I don't think that the book, as you read it, you understand, I'm not endorsing one way or the other. I'm just laying it out there throughout history. This is what people have been doing. And I think from the response, a lot of people, it really helps them understand what a lot of the sharks or the aggressive people around them are doing to them. It kind of opens their eyes up and helps them defend themselves better.
Because, see, here's I guess, I don't know if you're familiar, I have a book called Mold One, Let the Women Know What You're Really Thinking, and then I have a second book called Upfront and Straightforward. So it's interesting reading your book, quite honestly, because there's some themes in your book that I'm actually totally am behind.
Right.
And then on the exact opposite end, there's other, because I'm all about non-manipulative behavior and just being straightforward. Now, the themes that I agree with, particularly with your latest book, The 50th Law, I'm all about being bold and fearless.
Okay.
Totally feeling that. Totally feeling that. And while we're talking about fear, what, in your opinion, what can cause a person to go from being, say, a timid and or conservative-minded type person to a bold, fearless, risk-taking state of mind?
Well, it's not easy. You know, in the 50th law, I'm not trying to say that everybody can instantly become 50 Cent or Napoleon Bonaparte or anybody like that. That we live in a culture that people are very fearful. It's things that the media feeds us. And it's not natural for us to be bold. And so it's a process that you have to go through. It's not like overnight you're going to turn from a mouse into a lion. But the most important step, and this is what we emphasize in the book, is being aware of how you have so many fears inside of you and how they're holding you back and how they're making you unhappy. I believe fears are generally one of the main sources of unhappiness in life. It causes you to not to take chances, to do anything, to live. It makes you not want to live. And so that awareness, that moment where you become aware of it and realize that, yes, I could have a different attitude towards life, is like the first step. And sometimes circumstances will transform you. If you suddenly had a lot of money and you lost it, and now you were forced into sort of getting things for yourself, maybe you suddenly would become bolder and aggressive. So circumstances can play a role. But generally, it takes effort. And that's what the book is about. Each chapter shows you fears that are inhibiting you. And once you become aware of that, I think you can start taking steps to overcome your fears.
Hmm. Now, was it because of 50s demeanor that made you focus primarily on fearlessness in the 50th law?
Well, you know, I started off with a premise. I thought, I think of 50 as kind of an embodiment of a lot of the characters I write about in my books. He's a great seducer if you're ever around him, like I've been. He's very crafty. He can be both the fox and the lion, as Machiavelli describes. But here I had a chance to sort of study him in action, as opposed to all these people that I read about in books. And I wanted to see what it was, that quality that he had, that allowed him to become who he is. It's an insane story of somebody growing up in an extremely dangerous environment, no parental supervision. His mother was murdered when he was 8. He never knew his father. His grandparents basically were too busy to really supervise him. And time and again, he faced these incredible obstacles, basically hustling on the streets where he should have been killed, to getting into music where most people never last more than a few months, even if they do have success. T- time and again, he overcame these incredible obstacles to go from the bottom of America to what, you know, what most of us would consider the top. What is it about him? What is that quality? I wanted to come up with what is that thing inside of him that allowed him to push past all these obstacles. And spending time with him, being around him, talking with him, I decided that really you could boil it all down to this man has so much less fear than you or I or most other people. Some of that comes from being nearly killed. You know, somebody tried to assassinate him, and mm-hmm. he survived, and he almost was killed. Basically a near-death experience. Mm-hmm. That kind of drummed out of him the last bits of fear, and I decided that is what allowed him to be a good hustler and then get out of hustling, which is a very bold thing. Most hustlers are trapped in that life forever. Then to get into music and then to be successful, to survive in that horrible environment, and then to create this business empire. So that's where it was. I think that's the essence of the man. That's what allowed him to survive where most people don't survive.
Hmm. Now, in your book, you say, out of fear, we've developed religion and various belief systems to comfort us.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that most religions are based kind of on just mythical beliefs and invalid principles?
No, I mean, I'm not. I find a lot of strength and beauty, poetry, great philosophy in the world's religions. I read a lot about all of the religions. But I do think that I like to look at very primitive mankind before we were civilized and the frightening nature of the world that we were facing as we became aware of our environment and aware of death and how threatening the world was, that religion was born out of those intense, intense fears. And that it actually had an incredibly powerful calming effect on us. Religion played a major role in civilizing mankind. We would not be here today without that power. And in fact, we're suffering for the decline of religious belief. And the sense that we're alone in the universe and that we're all having to confront our mortality, it's a terrifying thing. And I understand it very deeply, and I have a whole chapter on it. You're quoting from that chapter, chapter 10. So I don't think of religion as, a lot of people do think of it as the cause of all the problems in the world. I don't. But I do think at the very beginning of time that religion did come from the tremendous fear and awe that we had in looking at the world around us.
Now, I'm sure you must hear, speaking of also of religion, that I'm assuming that people who are devout Christians and, you know, really into the Bible just really take exception to a lot of your laws from 1 to 50. What kind of feedback do you get from primarily, like, you know, real...
Well, it depends on the book. You know, this new book, The 50th Law, I think people who are readers of the Bible, for instance, won't have any problem with it. And, you know, I do quote from various parts of the Bible, actually. Surprisingly, with the 48 laws, it was quite divided. There are people who hated it, who are very religious. And then there were a lot of religious people, Christians, who thought the book was fantastic. And, you know, if you read the Bible, as I've read it several times, there are a lot of stories in there in which human nature is displayed in its nakedness, and a lot of it is quite brutal. It's a very honest book in a way. So it was very divided. I do think a lot of people who are of the kind of Gandhian side and see that private morality is the same thing as public morality took very much exception to the 48 laws and do not like it. And I still get a lot of criticism from people like that. So that kind of transcends Christianity or any sort of religion. But surprisingly, there were a lot of Christians who really liked the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, going on this theme of fearlessness in the 50th law, what are the top two ways that most human beings deal with fear?
Well, you know, when in daily life, if you're assuming that your life is reasonably comfortable as it is for a lot of Americans, well, of course, nowadays that's changing, most people avoid it. They don't confront the various fears that they have in life, and they try and drown it out with habits and, you know, entertainment and socializing and doing things and avoiding the source of the problem. So most people, as I say it, are in this avoidance mode, and they're not aware of what's going on. And, you know, people can disguise the fact that they're fearful. I have an idea in the book, called The Masks of Fear. And so it's not something that anybody wants to be proud of. Nobody goes around saying, you know, I'm a fearful person. So what happens is you'll get somebody who's on the outside very aggressive and loud and, you know, kind of like a Bill O'Reilly or those types, yelling a lot. And in fact, that's kind of a mask for all of the fears and insecurities that they have. A person with fear doesn't want to accept the possibility that there are other ideas in the world, that what they think could be wrong, that there might be another way of doing something. They're very rigid, but they disguise it to themselves and to other people with all kinds of behavior. So most people are trying to avoid this and not really aware of it. If, however, circumstances change, let's say you face like a disaster, excuse me there, you have no money, there's an emergency, you have an illness or whatever, you'll find often that we do have these reservoirs of strength inside all of us. We are actually, at any moment, I think this is maybe sort of what you were talking about earlier, and maybe I could revise that answer, but we do have more strength and fearlessness in us than we're aware. It's just that it doesn't happen until something bad happens, and then we have to be strong, and we have to confront the situation, and we realize it's not as bad as we thought. So there, you know, you're either avoiding it, or it's in your face, and you're aware that you have to get past this fear, or you're going to die, or you're not going to succeed in life. So those, I think, are the two obvious ways of handling.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think, excuse me, do you think formal education, and you're a formally educated man, Berkeley, but for some people, surely not for everyone, but for some people, do you think it's overrated? Because, you know, in reading the book, you kind of emphasize how Curtis Jackson, a.k.a. 50 Cent, he comes from the streets. He didn't attend any Ivy League institution.
Right.
But yet he earns more than the average Ivy League graduate does. So how do you explain people who come from the streets without any collegiate education rising to the heights of success?
Well, you know, it's almost not, yeah, your education can almost be a barrier because you learn certain things and then that becomes set in stone in your mind. Let's see, what you've got a business degree, and they teach you in business school that this is the model that you need to follow. This is how money is made or not made, and your head is just crammed with all this information, and you're not able to think for yourself. And so we're living in a time of drastic change, where all of the old models are dissolving. I'm witnessing it in book publishing. You see it in music. You see what's happening to the banking system. Everything is just crashing in front of us. And people with education, almost it's a burden because they can't let go of all of these ideas and just see things as they are. And you take somebody from the streets like Curtis, and he now has the privilege of being in corporate America. He runs a $150 million, $200 million empire. He doesn't have that burden. He comes from the streets. He was a hustler, and in the 50th law, each chapter I go in quite deeply into the hustler mentality because I believe America and 50 wrote this in his autobiography. It's a hustler's country. We have a hustler's mentality, and I wanted to get at the psychology. A hustler on the streets is just looking at things as they are and seeing how can I make money out of this situation? How can I get an advantage? How can I get some power? What's going on around me? He or she does not have all of these ideas from school or books or whatever. And in the world nowadays where things are changing so fast and it's so chaotic out there, I think that that mentality is actually quite powerful. And I wanted to show it because, you know, look what happened with music business, the piracy going on. 50, before anybody else, he said, all right, this is the reality. I'm not going to fight it. I'm going to embrace it. I'm going to find ways to use this piracy and attract people to my music through my name, and then I'll get them to buy other things. So that's a typical hustler mentality, what I call turning shit into sugar. That's one of the titles of the book.
Yeah, I remember the chapter.
That's a classic example of taking something negative and turning it into a positive, a hustler's mentality through and through. I think people like that from the streets have a definite advantage right now in the business world. And it used to be like that in America, 19th century America. We were formed by a bunch of hustlers who decided to get into business and created what we know of as the United States of America.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of formal education, I've heard many in the entertainment industry say that a good example would be Keenan Ivory Wayans. He was in a position to earn his bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
And he specifically avoided because he said he didn't want to feel like he had a backup, something to fall back. Because, you know, conventional wisdom says always have a backup. But he didn't want to have a backup. I know Rosie O'Donnell has said that. What do you think about that attitude of entertainment industry types not wanting to have a degree or anything else similar as a backup?
Well, I don't want to give the impression that I'm against education because it made me who I am today. And I think learning and reading, I can't emphasize how invaluable that can be, having an analytical mind in this world. But, you know, people have crutches. Everybody kind of uses crutches. And that's what chapter 2 in the book is all about, being self-reliant and not having these, and learning to stand on your own. And so, you know, normally a person will look at their degree from Harvard or wherever it is as a kind of crutch that'll allow them now to get what they want in life. And, you know, you don't. It doesn't get you anywhere. In fact, you know, in New York City, there are cab drivers who have degrees from Harvard. It's your attitude, your character that will determine where you end up. And if you're always relying on mommy and daddy, on your degree, on other people's money, on your connections, someday they're going to disappear, and you're not able to do things for yourself. So I'm a huge believer in self-reliance, and if that means you don't want to have a degree because it's a crutch, and you want to, I'm all for that. You need to find some way in life to motivate yourself and find and get some drive and purpose and energy. And whatever that would be, I'm all in favor of it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are your thoughts on Curtis's comment that most people are afraid of being their true selves? What does that really mean?
Well, that's a really important chapter in the book because we have this. What we say in there is, you know, and I believe it's true, everybody is born unique and different. Your DNA, it'll never be repeated. Just who you are and your experiences, you are one of a kind. But as you get older, particularly in your teenage years, you start to become afraid of what makes you different, and you start thinking that what you need to do is be more like other people, and conform and fit into the group and dress like other people and think like other people. And that might give you some degree of comfort and security, but it comes at a huge price, because what I believe, or what we believe, makes somebody powerful is accessing that uniqueness, that individuality, what makes you different from everybody else. There's so much power in that. It's a power, like, if you ever meet a person who's comfortable as an individual, it's extremely seductive. You want to be around them. So So it has that kind of power over other people, a sort of confidence. But it also has another power in that you discover what you're good at in life, what you were meant to do, and you follow that path, and you don't think, worry about what other people are thinking. He embodies that because, you know, he could have followed a very simple path in life. He could have been a hustler. He was good at it, made money, and stayed there, and he probably would have either died or he'd be in prison right now. He could have then got into music, and he could have followed the trends that people were doing and played the whole industry game, and he'd be a forgotten rapper. He could have gotten into business, but just sort of done the usual thing, like, you know, promoting alcohol and, you know, things like what most rappers end up promoting. Each time he decided, no, I'm just going to be myself. I don't care what other people think. I'm going to get out of hustling. I'm going to create a sound that no one ever has had before. I'm going to do business things that are unconventional, like vitamin water and all the other things. He's himself. And if people don't like it, that's fine. He doesn't care. It's just that's what made him powerful, and I think what can make anybody powerful.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you believe, now, first of all, my show deals with self-improvement in general, but particularly as it relates to dating and relationships.
Uh-huh.
So I want to ask you, both in general and even more specifically in respect to dating relationships, do you think it's better to be impetuous than cautious?
In a seductive type of situation?
Yeah, as a man pursuing a woman and beginning to interact with her.
Well, in general, I would say yes, but there's always, everybody's different. And let's say a man pursuing a woman, there are women who've had bad experiences, who, if they're very particularly beautiful, a lot of men have kind of preyed upon them, and they're very skittish. And if you start coming in with an extremely impetuous approach, they're going to run away from you. And so you have to measure each person that you're getting involved with and treat them as an individual and see their strengths and their weaknesses. I think in general, a lot of women will respond to the bold approach, and that nowadays the great sin of most men is that they are way too timid, way too cautious. It's not, it doesn't read as masculine behavior. It's not sexual. It doesn't have that energy and that animal drive that I think it can be very attractive. Mm-hmm. I think most men err on the side of being timid. But that said, there are degrees of boldness. Just simply on the first date attacking a woman, that's not seduction. That's just insecurity. Your boldness has to be channeled. It has to be smart. You have to know how to use it well. You have to know when the time is right to move on to the attack, if I'm going to, you know, talk that way. So it's not just a matter of rushing in like a lion and attacking the woman. That doesn't seem romantic. But it's a general kind of sense of confidence that you have. I think that's what I think is seductive, and that feeling that you feel secure with yourself, that's the kind of boldness that I think works really well.
Well, see, this is what I started off saying. I said that there's points in your book, both this book, 50th Law and 48 Laws of Power, where there's themes that I totally agree with, such as everything you just said about being bold and not being too cowardly, because that's what I basically espouse in my book.
Mm-hmm.
But then here's the area, honestly, where we begin to separate. Mm-hmm. I believe that a man should be upfront and straightforward with his, which hence is the title of my show, with his desires, interests, and intentions. But your Law 3 in the 48 Laws of Power basically says that, in so many words, honesty is overrated, that you should conceal your intentions. Honesty is actually a blunt instrument which bloodies more than it cuts.
Right.
Why do you think honesty is a disadvantageous tool?
Well, you know, honesty is, there are degrees of it. And I'm just going to lay it all out. I'm going to be straightforward and honest right
okay,
here.
Okay, okay.
You know, From the day we're born, we realize that if we tell people exactly what we feel, A, we're going to hurt them and they'll never talk to us again, and B, we're not going to get very far in life. We learn it. It's ingrained in us. So with the teacher, we don't tell the teacher that we think they're ugly and that they don't know what they're stupid. With our boss, we don't say that that's a bad idea and go away, I could do it better. We know that we cannot be completely honest in this world. And there are moments when honesty is the right thing. It's beautiful. And if we're talking about what works and doesn't work, if we're divorcing it from the moral realm and we're saying what works in seduction or power and what doesn't work, there are moments where being honest is effective and good and should be used, and I talk about that. And there are many moments when it's not. And so, for instance, I compare seduction, if we're talking now about seduction, to a kind of mating ritual where two people, let's just say a man and a woman, are kind of doing this ritual dance that will end up in sex or partnership or whatever you want to say. And if a man just simply comes right in there and says, woman, I want to have sex with you, let's get it over with, which is mostly, let's be honest, that's what most men think. They want sex. They want it right away. It's not going to get you anywhere. It's not going to seduce a woman. And so what men have learned, which is I maintain in the art of seduction that women created this form of power and this art, but men have learned from them, we've learned that we have to romance somebody. And it's a beautiful thing, in fact. And we have to
I don't mean to interrupt you, but see, this is... This is how my book came about. I actually have had experiences where I've approached a woman, told her from the word go that my main interest was exchanging orgasms with her.
Yeah.
And I got favorable results from that. Now, sure, I've had my share of rejection from that approach, but I've had a lot of success. Here's, I guess, why I differ, and then you can respond to this.
Uh-huh.
This is what I see a lot of guys do in the dating scene is, let's say we got Brian who meets Linda and he knows he wants to exchange orgasms with Linda. But he feels like if he's upfront and straightforward with his desire and interest that she's probably going to reject him and think he's a shallow jerk. So instead he conceals that and hides that those desires, interests, and intentions, and he plays the whole gentleman role. But if Linda is very manipulative herself, she's going to talk him into taking her out to lunch, taking her out to dinner, taking her to a concert. And then after she's played him for a chump, she's going to give him the talk and say, Brian, you're a great guy. You're a sweet guy, but I have no romantic interest in you whatsoever.
Well,
he comes back and says, man, she's a bitch. She used me. But my take on this is that if he had been straightforward, he would have forced her to do one or two things, which is reciprocate his interest or reject his interest. And there would be no game plan whatsoever. But you would say by law three, though, that he should kind of lay off on expressing his interest.
No. I, what I'm trying to say is everything depends on circumstance. If for you it works, your approach to a woman, I want to exchange orgasms, then fine, all the power to you. I'm all a pragmatist. What works, works. Mm-hmm. But my experience is different from yours. I feel that that will work with some women, but that it, for a lot of women, it'll be a terrible turnoff because they want to feel that you want that something more than that. And in general, I think, you know, there are situations where that's all you want, but oftentimes you do want an interaction of some sort, a relationship, something more than that. And you need a man needs to make an effort, and that effort includes seduction, the whole process of seducing a woman. And I'm trying to say in the book that you don't have to see that as manipulative. You don't have to see that as ugly and stupid. You can see that as actually pleasurable. To seduce a woman, to do it well, is actually a great joy in life. It's actually more fun, more pleasurable than actual simple orgasm. You will end up, if you seduce a woman well, you will end up having a much better sexual relationship than just, to me, than the straightforward approach. And if Brian, in your example, if he knew, if he read my book, The Art of Seduction, and had his eyes open to what really seduces a woman, he would have Linda eating out of the palm of his hand. She wouldn't ever get to that point of saying, "Well, look, I got all my lunch and everything. Goodbye." He's a lame seducer. And, you know, I'm saying that this is an art, and it's a beautiful art, and it's something that men and women have been doing for centuries. And if you master it, it's going to make everything better. You know, for some people, as for yourself, and I won't deny that maybe this is not your game and you prefer the straightforward way, all the power to you. It's just, I think a lot of people, it doesn't work like that. I think a lot of women won't respond to it, but I could be wrong.
Okay, now in your book, you essentially say this to your benefit to be able to, this is in the 50th law, to see through the bullshit and manipulative head games of others in order to be successful.
Yeah.
But, okay. Clarify that for me, because you say you want people to be in a position where they can see the bullshit and manipulations of others, but if they're busy kind of involved in their own bullshit and manipulations, how do they see that in others?
Well, you know, I'll separate those out here. You know, we live in a world of a lot of bullshit, a lot of fakery. People, they're not being themselves. And, you know, this is separate from the game of seduction I'm talking about in business or in entertainment or in politics, for instance. And you, as a person who is fearless and wants power in life, you have to have the ability to see through it all. You have to have a firm grasp on reality. You have to be able to observe people and say, like in the beginning I told you about the Bill O'Reilly type that yells and screams and intimidates people. You need to be so sharp that you see through that bullshit and you understand that this guy's actually weak and cowardly, and I can use that to my advantage if he crosses my path. So this is the 50th law. It's all about being a consummate realist. You know, it's the hustle, like I call it the hustler's eye. It's like a diamond. It just pierces through everything. You see what people are up to, what their intentions are, what their games are. You're not naive, and you move from there. Now, in my books, you know, I say that there are moments in life when you yourself are going to be forced to manipulate, or you're going to choose to manipulate. And this is what people in the past have done to gain power. That doesn't mean you yourself are naive and believe everybody is a good person and that what they say is what they really mean. It just means upon occasion you yourself know how to play that game that other people are playing so well. So it's just all about being sharp and realistic and not being so naive in life.
So you're saying that you would be able, if you were following, say, your own 48 laws of power plus the 50th
right.
law, that you would be able to easily recognize someone else who's employing the 48 laws of power.
Well, I'm not perfect. If you're talking about me, I'll have moments where I'll be deceived, you know, and 50 has been deceived. He early on, when he became successful, he brought in all of these artists under his label, G-Unit Records, thinking he was going to do this, that, and the other with them, and it would be all one great happy family. And then they kind of all played the similar game where they were almost using him to catapult their careers, and they were really lazy, and he was totally deceived and manipulated. And he wised up and he learned. And that's my process. People are always, not always, because I don't believe that, but sometimes people to this day will do some kind of game with me. And I might fall for it, but once I realize what's going on, I learned a lesson, and I'm not going to repeat that again. So to me, it's not about not making mistakes or failing in life or sometimes being deceived. It's about learning and having your eyes open. And when something, when a person plays a game on you, you catch it if you can in time, and if not, you realize they're not going to do that again to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, listeners, if you want to call in and ask a question of my guest this evening or make a comment based on the conversation thus far, you can call in to 646-478-5710. Again, that's 646-478-5710. If you have a question related to either the 50th Law, his latest book, or you might have a question related to the Art of Seduction and or the 48 Laws of Power, please call in. Right now, I'm going to take about a four-minute intermission. Let my guest, Mr. Green, get a swig of water. And but don't go anywhere. We'll be right back in roughly about 4 minutes more with the author of The 50th Law, Robert Greene.
Hey, I'm Dangerously. And you may have read my short story, Till Death Do Us Part, in the New York Times bestselling anthology, Succulent, Chocolate Flavor 2, presented by Zane. Well, things get even hotter between the pages of Keep Your Panties Up and Your Skirt Down. Check it out at PantiesUpSkirtDown.com. And remember, keep it dangerous.
What's up, folks? This is Alan Roger Curry of Upfront and Straightforward and Mode 1 fame. And if you're a music lover, I urge you to listen to Madison Media Radio. It's not just music, but it is music with a purpose. Right here on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network.
Mode 1.
Do you think that guys, to one degree or another, have to play the role of the bad boy to attract women, or they just need to remain who they are and just, you know, be patient?
No, they need to combine their game. They need to go in with an attitude that I'm going to be a gentleman, but I'm also letting you know that I'm attracted to you. You know, I want to kiss you. I want to hold you. I want to, you know, I want to take you out. I want to date you. You know, if you think I want to get in your pants, you're probably right. But at the same time, I like you. I like you. I want to see you.
You know, there's more single women than married women in the United States.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
It's over 51%. Yeah.
There's more what?
Okay.
There's more single women than married women in the United States right now. First time ever in history.
Mindsets is correct. Somewhere there's a woman that's balanced, that's God-focused, that, you know, she gives because she wants to give, not because she's trying to hook somebody with her giving, but she values herself. She recognizes her good qualities, acknowledges her bad qualities, and this is the person that's balanced and ready to be in a healthy relationship.
Just so the listeners know, there's a letter in my first book, Letters to a Young Brother, Manifest Your Destiny. It's called Finding Your Swagger. In fact, it's so funny. I just got a letter from a young brother that he read my book, and it's changed his life. And he also put it in, he said, and you know what? I found my swagger, and now all the girls like me like you said they would. I was so tickled by that, yeah.
Oh, man, you gotta love it. Single, lonely, confused, join me. I invite you to listen to the most informative and entertaining talk radio show on the internet for single men and single women looking to enhance their social lives, love lives, and or sex lives. Get on the phone right now and tell one or two of your single friends to listen to Upfront and Straightforward with yours truly, Alan Roger Curry, Thursday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, and 7 p.m. on the West Coast, right here on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network. Now return to my interview with New York Times best-selling book author Robert Greene on Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry right here on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network. Welcome back. Welcome back to tonight's edition of Upfront and Straightforward. We're now moving into the second hour of this discussion, and it's been a very interesting, enlightening, informative discussion with my highly esteemed guest for the evening. He is the New York Times best-selling author of The 48 Laws of Power, The Art of Seduction, The 33 Laws of War, and his latest entry is entitled The 50th Law, which had a contributor by the name of Curtis Jackson. You hip-hop fans know him as 50 Cent. He contributed heavily to Robert Greene's latest book, and we're chopping it up. Again, listeners, if you have a question or comment, you can call in at 646-478-5710. And speaking of the phone lines, I'm going to go to area code 347-347. You're now up front and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry and my guest, Robert Greene. What's your question tonight?
What's good, Brother Alan? What's good, Robert? My question is about on page 65, you talk about step 4, make your enterprise a reflection of your individuality. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that? Because then on page 66, you say how you must not be afraid of your uniqueness and you must care less and less what people think of you. And one of the things that I've personally experienced is that a lot of people oftentimes find themselves getting angry at other people for simply being who they are, and that's because they're not being who they're supposed to be.
Right. Well, you know, I've noticed that in my dealings with, like, successful corporations, businesses, that inevitably the, let's say, Microsoft or Google, place like that, if you go there, it's weird how the whole place seems to reflect the mentality of one person, Bill Gates or the Brin guys at Google. And it's because something successful usually comes from an individual, perhaps two people, who bring their own uniqueness to the world, some new idea that's never been tried before, some new sound in music, some new kind of concept for a book or a movie, and it's a reflection of who they are, and people respond to that because there's so much crap out there and so much many people who are following other people and not doing what their own destiny is, that when we see somebody out there doing something unique that's never been tried before and it resonates, well, we're just totally seduced by that, or we buy that product, or we follow that person. And so that's what your goal in life is. Now, you can't start that way. You can't immediately, if you're 23 years old, or maybe you can, but it's not easy. You can't just suddenly create a business or an enterprise that's completely unique. It's a process that you're going through in life, and you're certainly finding your way. But your goal eventually is to make that business something that's a reflection of your personality and your deepest desires. And I maintain that that's the path of real power, particularly in this world where things are changing so fast and all the old business models are dissolving and it's no longer the case where you're going to be working 20 years at the same company.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did that answer your question, caller?
Just one other thing.
Yeah.
I know that you're from Brooklyn and particularly from Fort Greene. Tell us a little bit about your Brooklyn experience. How did that impact your writing?
Well, my mother is actually born in Brooklyn. And then I moved to New York in the early 80s, and I was a struggling journalist and writer, and I just had no money, and at the time couldn't afford Manhattan, so I moved to what's kind of Sunset Park area, Park Slope, Sunset Park area. And then then my girlfriend and I, ended up moving to Fort Greene, and it was an amazing, amazing experience. We were the only white people in the area.
Yeah.
Fort Greene has since changed a lot. I ventured to Myrtle Avenue one day, and I was mugged. And I learned very quickly where I had to go, where I didn't have to go. And I ended up loving Fort Greene. I mean, that place has so much atmosphere and is so alive. I think it's probably changed a lot. But I have deep roots from Brooklyn, from my mother, from growing up as a Dodger fan, from living there. And I have a lot of friends who live there now. So I love Brooklyn.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Continue success with the book, brother.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
All right.
Thank you
Take
for calling
easy,
in, Doc. Let me see if I got another area code 757. Area code 757. You're now up front and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry and my guest, Mr. Robert Green. What's your question this evening?
This is just a comment. I just really thank you for this interview because I wasn't feeling too good about, 48 laws and whatnot. It felt a little manipulative and whatnot. I did read, the Art of Seduction, but it's just great. I'm going to go reread it now.
Both the Art of Seduction and the 48 Laws?
No, just Art of Seduction. I read it at the library and wasn't too, but now it seems a lot more better than,
Well, I'd say that, I get... book's been out now for 11 years, I guess. I get a lot of emails from people, particularly lately. It sort of seems to have expanded. And 90% of it is from people who have been manipulated by other people. Like they're in an environment. It could be in prison. It can be in a business or wherever. And they're dealing with some dangerous, sharky type people, and the book has really helped them. And I must admit, I was sort of like that myself. I'm not maybe the master manipulator. I had that kind of played on me in Hollywood when I worked there. So a lot of the book, I think, is really for people who aren't too aware or feel who can be a little bit naive. I think the book can really help you. So it's maybe not as evil as you might think, or as it seems on the surface.
I don't know if I. Here's my thing. I say in my second book, and this is me.
Mm-hmm.
There's a saying, and I saw even somebody say this in the chat room. They said you can't bullshit a bullshitter. But I actually take the belief just the opposite. I think the easiest person to bullshit is someone who's engaged in their own bullshit. I believe when I'm upfront and straightforward with people, it's very difficult for people to bullshit me because I know what I want. I know what I'm willing to give up to get what I want.
Yeah.
And I'm just not going to be swayed or sweet-talked or whatever. Whereas I find in my past, in my experiences, when I was younger, tried to engage in, say, various manipulative games, I ended up at least one-third or one-half the time being manipulated. So one of the things I always tell some of my book readers is that manipulation works when you're dealing with somebody, and you just recently used the word naive. When you're dealing with somebody who's totally naive, that's when I think manipulation works. But I think when you engage in manipulative behavior with someone who's a more skilled
manipulator than you are, mm-hmm. you're going to get played. And that's why I have an aversion to manipulative head games. But there's a lot of things you say, though, that, I'm all about the 50th law. I like the fearlessness, the theme on that.
Okay.
Because I'm all about that. Like, you know, my book is all about overcoming. Again, I deal mainly with dating relationships. You kind of deal with a more broader, just kind of almost whole life. But I specifically deal with overcoming the fear of rejection and overcoming the fear of harsh criticism from women. Let me take another call real quick before I return to my own questions. Area code, I guess this is a Skype number, area code 111. You're now up front and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry, my guest Robert Green. Do you have a question this evening? Hello? Hello, going once, going twice. Okay, nobody was there. I guess they get verbally shy, and I see another number. Area code 219, you just listening or you have a question for Robert Green? I see, Robert, you intimidating these people. You're using one of your laws to intimidate my listeners. They're on the phone queue, but they're not saying anything. Do you believe it is a blessing in disguise for a person to hit rock bottom at some point in their life? You think that will provoke them to take more risk?
Yes. It can work that way. Some people hitting rock bottom just, that's the end, and we never hear from them again. It really depends on who you are. I talk in the 50th law about that moment when 50 hit rock bottom after he was killed, somebody tried to kill him, and he had lost his record contract, and he couldn't hustle again, and he couldn't sing, and it looked like he was finished. And he managed from that experience to drum up all of this energy and sense of urgency because he knew how short life is. Sometimes, you know, we're not really aware, we're not connected to the reality of the world and how short our lives are. We live in this kind of bubble from TV and internet and things like that. And when you hit rock bottom or things are bad, it can really wake you up to what matters, to where you want to go in life. You could have a job that you're just sort of skimming along the surface, and it makes things easy, but you're not happy. And then that job is gone. You're either going to sink or swim now. You're going to find some other crappy job to hold on to, or you're going to actually become an entrepreneur and create your own business. So facing reality and facing failure, however you want to put it, I think can be a really transformative experience for most people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I agree with that. You had a quote. You had a lot of quotes that interest me. One was you said, understand we live in a society of relative prosperity, but in many ways this turns out to be a detriment to our spirit.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's the whole thing about the hustler mentality is you don't have much to work with. You don't have any money. You don't have connections. You don't have good products to sell or whatever. And you make the most of it so your mind becomes very active and creative. And when you have a lot of prosperity, when you have a lot of money, your mind tends to become lazy. And I talk in the war book, I think the epitome of this is the Vietnam War. Here you had the United States with just unbelievable weaponry, the most sophisticated computer equipment and tanks and planes, facing off against a basically very primitive culture that had the material of something from the 19th century, and they beat us rather soundly in the Vietnam War because they were infinitely more creative with the little that they had, and they were more motivated. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the more you have in life, the less creative you are. So I say in the war book, I say in all my books, if you happen to be somebody that has means and money. You have to act like you don't. And you have to understand that power in this world doesn't come from money. It doesn't come from technology. It comes from your head and your ideas and your skill. And so sometimes, you know, having less will end up making you more creative.
Yeah, I generally agree with that. Do you believe it's to a person's benefit to be an opportunist?
Well, in the book, I try and redefine the word because, you know, in generally we see that word as negative, like it's just somebody who will do anything to get ahead in life, and that's not how I see the word. I see the word as somebody who sees everything that happens in life as an opportunity. So if something bad happens to you, then it's a lesson that is opening your eyes to something you've done wrong. Or it could be a way for you to turn it around, or it could turn into some positive publicity in which you make yourself look like an underdog. So you end up, it's a philosophy of life that I think is just so powerful. If you see everything in life as an opportunity, then nothing bothers you, then nothing gets you down. A bad event is merely a reminder of how life can be short or how you're not the smartest person and you need to learn. Everything is an opportunity, and if you end up thinking that way, then you are an opportunist, and I think it's a very, very powerful philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you about somebody who this is not a real person, this is a fictional character.
Okay.
Who I would think probably, within the context of this movie, probably would have read The 48 Laws of Power. Give me your take on the Michael Douglas character of Gordon Gekko.
Well, you know, that's kind of what you would think of in some ways of somebody from The 48 Laws of Power who's a master manipulator, and you know he uses the Martin Sheen. Charlie Sheen character for his own purposes, sort of as a cat's paw, and all of that. But in fact, if you read my book closely and you read all my books, you know that kind of character is actually really limited. And you know when. We've experienced a lot of that in Wall Street recently with all the funny money that was going on, all the derivatives and the credit schemes people were coming up with. That kind of greed and short-sightedness is not, to me, the essence of power. All of my icons of power in the book are people who think long-term and who want to create something that lasts. So the Gordon Gekkos of the world are really good at kind of building up an empire for a few years, but they can't hold on to it because they're greedy, they're impatient, they don't know how to get people to like them, to follow them, to want to work for them. And eventually those types end up getting stabbed in the back or they kind of hoist it on their own petard. They don't last very long. And so that's sort of my take on him. And, you know, people like that are fascinating. That's why that movie did so well. That's why we're so interested in The Godfather and Al Pacino character or in Scarface or with Gordon Gekko. These types fascinate us because we're always fascinated by the kind of villain who knows how to manipulate. But that's not what my books are about. That's an aspect of the game of power. But if that's the only thing you know how to do, I maintain you're not going to last very long.
So you believe in behavior that's kind of sprinkled, so to speak, here and there with manipulation and deception here and there, but that's not the main basis to your message.
Well, I mean, I think of it as kind of soft and hard, the power game. So let's say I look at, like, politics and a president. If you're too soft, and you're just a good guy, and you're not prepared for all the political games people are playing and all the nastiness, then you'll end up like Jimmy Carter. You'll be a nice guy, but it doesn't last very long and is not really well respected. Then there's the hard game. But if that's all that you know, all you know is how to manipulate and deal with the political people out there, then you'll end up like Nixon, and you know, people will end up hating you and reviling you, and you won't be a very successful in the long run. You have to mix the two together. You don't have to occasionally, you have to play that hard game. There's just no way around it. There are moments where you have to take a step back. I talk in the 50th Law about how Abraham Lincoln had to do that in order to end slavery in the United States. He had to play a very deceptive game and be very political. At the same time, you know that that's not certainly not the only thing, and you have to inspire people. You have to be a great leader. And I think Barack Obama has the material to be my kind of model. I think people like FDR or Lincoln were that. And I extrapolate that to the lesson in life. If you can call it sprinkling. If you're not naive, you're aware of what other people can do. Occasionally, you have to play the hard game. But in general, you're not doing it. Maybe you're being more upfront and straightforward, as you like to put it.
Well, yeah, upfront. Okay, let me ask you, and I know you don't, your forte is not specifically dating relationships, but let me ask you this. Do you think, okay, are you familiar with what's known as the attraction and seduction community?
Yes.
Okay, I've kind of had a philosophical battle with a lot of the guys in this.
Are you talking like the pickup artist community?
Yeah, the pickup artist community.
Yes, I know a lot about them. Yeah.
Okay, so their basic premise is whatever it takes to get a woman in bed,
mm-hmm.
that's what you should do.
Right.
Basically, forget ethics, forget all that. If lying to a woman gets her in bed, you're successful. If whining and dining gets her in bed. And so let me ask you this question, and I don't know if this directly relates to your laws, but let's say you pretty much, you met a woman, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you just pretty much wanted casual sex.
Yeah.
Would you feel like it's okay to lead that woman into believing that you're falling for her and wanted a long-term monogamous relationship when actually you just wanted to tap that ass?
It really depends. It really depends. I mean, in general, personally, I don't get much satisfaction out of that because I want the woman to be engaging her willpower as much as possible. I don't want her just simply being deceived into it. I want her to, maybe she resists me or she doesn't, but the deception makes it too easy, and then there's no real pleasure in that. however, you could be dealing with someone that's, you know, I don't know what it is, but maybe that is really what they want in the end, to be kind of deceived. You know, a lot of women are really attracted to the bad guy, to the rake, to the naughty boy or whatever it is. They're really attracted to that, and they want to be deceived. They want to be manipulated.
Now that's a strong statement. You saying women want to be deceived and manipulated?
Some do.
Some do.
Yeah, I mean, I talk in the book about what I call the new prude or the prudish woman. And in history, if you look at the type of woman that will fall for a rake, they're usually women who are very prudish, who are the opposite. And secretly, this is the kind of thing that they want. So there are going to be circumstances where I think that approach is fine and it'll work, and actually the woman will end up getting quite a bit of pleasure out of it. And maybe you deceived her and you dump her, but it's certainly a lot more fun than anything she's ever had before. So if that's the circumstance, then, you know, I'm all for it. I guess I'm a little more liberal with my morals. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, since you brought up rake, I want you to explain to my audience, because they might not be familiar with these terms.
Yeah.
Just briefly explain the term siren, rake, ideal lover,
yeah.
Dandy, the natural, the coquette, the charmer, the charismatic, I know I'm laming all of them, the star, and the anti-seducer. And maybe, you know, two or three sentences kind of give us a gist of what each of those.
Well, what I'm doing in The Art of Seduction is I'm saying that each person fits a kind of a character type of a seducer. And you have to recognize what you're naturally good at and use it and bring it out. And so I come up with these nine types. And so a siren is a woman, because there's no such thing really as a male siren. She's a woman who just reeks of sexual energy. It can be very obvious, like a Marilyn Monroe, or it can be a little more hidden, like a Cleopatra, whatever. You're not. It comes in several forms, but it's like when a man is around the siren, it's just this. It appeals to the animal in him, and he cannot resist. And it's a very primitive, primal feeling that such a woman stirs up. And, you know, I talk in the book of all sorts of examples in history. The rake is the male kind of equivalent of a siren. It's only a man. And a rake is a man who is just obsessed with women, but it's never one woman. It has to be as many as possible. And he radiates this intense interest in women and desire for them. And for a lot of women, it's very seductive, even though they know that this is a bad guy and he's probably going to dump them. But the fact that in that moment, in that week or month that he's interested in them, it's intense and it's real, and it's much more intense than what she's ever experienced from any other man before.
Like a serial monogamous.
I've never heard that before. But
you never heard of that term?
A serial monogamous?
Serial monogamous, that's a guy who's similar to a womanizer, but he doesn't necessarily want multiple partners. He will, like, say, date one woman for, like, say, 6 weeks to 2 months, dump them. Then date another woman for, like, maybe 2 or 3 months, dump them.
Right.
And,
well, that is very much it. And what it is that's so seductive to women is the intensity of his desire in that moment is so strong that they can't resist it. And the rake makes the woman feel very desirable. And then the other types can be men or women. The ideal lover is a person who appeals to people's sort of fantasies and their ideals in life and kind of embodies them. The natural is somebody who's just very spontaneous. A person like a Duke Ellington was sort of a classic natural. They're like a child in an adult's body. They're so relaxed and comfortable with themselves that it makes other people relaxed and comfortable with themselves. The coquette is generally associated with women, but it can be a man or woman, and that's a person that knows how to blow hot or cold. That's the kind that you, Alan, probably hate. It's the most manipulative kind of seducer. Let's say it's a woman who comes on strong to a man, but the next day she's as cold as ice, and the guy's just like scratching his head. What the hell is going on here? And then the next day she's hot again, and it just drives you crazy, and they hook you in that way. It's a very, very powerful form of seduction.
Now, which one is that again?
The coquette.
The coquette, okay.
And then, you know, we have the charmer, which is a person that's usually kind of a social seducer, and they know how to please you and flatter you and make you feel so good about yourself that they charm you to death, and you just want to be around them. And then there's the star. I know what I left out, the dandy. The dandy is a type that's kind of a man that has sort of feminine attributes, or a woman with a little touch of masculinity. It's a kind of a slight androgynous thing, but it can actually be appealing to people who aren't necessarily homosexual. It's just they find that very exciting. And so a male dandy knows how to dress really well in colorful fashion, get attention, and it can be very powerful for women. And then, you know, then I have the charismatic, which is a person that just radiates self-confidence and belief to the point where they can found a religion just by the strength of their conviction. I talked in there about Malcolm X as a classic charismatic, or a Gandhi type person. And then there's the star, which is more like a creation out of Hollywood, although you find stars in real life. It's a person that just seems to embody all of the ideals in culture. They have distance you don't really feel like they're alive. They're almost like a fictional creature, and they're very vague, and you can never seize them or know them very well. You know, and I talked in there about people like John F. Kennedy was sort of a classic star. And then there's the anti-seducer, which is what you don't want to be in life, and that's a person that has all of the bad qualities, and that's someone who's insecure, who talks too much, who has no confidence and kind of bad timing, who's cheap. You know, cheapness is a really unseductive quality. And so, you know, that's the one thing you don't want to be.
Okay. Now, a mode one guy like myself.
Yeah.
Which one of those was somebody who's just would approach a woman and lay out all his interests on the table? What would that fall under?
Well, you know, I actually, you know, we're not that far apart, and I think that can be very powerful and very seductive. That's the natural. But so in the book, I have a character, the great actor Errol Flynn, and he was a serial monogamist, in your words.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great rakes in history. Supposedly, he slept with well over 2,000 women, close to 3,000. And he only lived till he was 49, so you do the math. And this guy was so relaxed, and he made it clear that that's what you were going to get with him. You were going to have sex with him, and he probably wouldn't last, see you more than a week or whatever. Women going in knew that that's what it was going to be, but he was so relaxed about it and so natural, and he had no problems with it, and he wasn't playing any games. Women would say that being around him, it was like drinking three martinis. He just lowered their inhibitions because he had no inhibitions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that can be very powerful, seductive ploy. It's just not everybody can pull that off, I think.
Okay. All right, I'm going to hit the phone line again. I got from New York City one of my Blog Talk Radio colleagues, Mr. Benny Barry White Voice Randall. Benny, you're now upfront and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry and Robert Green. What's your question and or comment?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Allen. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem.
Mr. Robert Green, I bought the audio version of the 48 Laws of Power.
Yes.
Okay. Now, something was very powerful in it, but I want you to elaborate on it a little bit because, you know, I come from a different era. Well, I came from the South where it was all about the more you have, the more you give. Now, you talked about the law of scarcity, okay, about the DLC, about there's only two things that exist, that's absence and presence.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I thought that was very powerful. Can you elaborate a little bit more on, because, see, I was the type of person, I thought when you got more, you were supposed to give more and give more, but it seemed like people took it less valuable when they had so much access to you versus when they have no access to you, then they'll spend an arm and a leg, they'll break an arm and a leg, and they may even apply some of the ideas that you put forth versus if you just give it all to them. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You know, there's so many sides to that. I mean, in pure economics, if there's the scarcity makes the price go up for any object. If it's harder to get, the price is higher. In a seductive type situation, if you're constantly present with this woman that you're trying to seduce, and you're just way too persistent, she might see you as someone who's desperate, and so your constant presence in her life becomes annoying and cloying, and she wants to get away from you. But if you learn how to sometimes not be so present and don't call her every day and give her some space, then her imagination takes over and she starts seeing you as somebody who's powerful. It's a game between absence and presence. So if you're always absent, or if what you have to offer is so scarce, then nobody will be able to buy it or no one will know who you are. But you have to know the art of when to be scarce and how to not make people, you know, wish that you were gone. Napoleon had an expression that if he appears in the theater every night, then people no longer see him as someone special. The trick was he would appear at the theater in public once a month, And then that became an event suddenly, and people thought, oh, my God, look at this person. And it created this kind of aura around him. So it's this fine art you have to learn about how to use your presence in the world, in your office, in your relationships, whatever. Use it, in a very careful fashion, and know when to be absent, and know when to make people appreciate you by your absence. You know, mm-hmm. If you're always there in the office, they'll take you for granted. But if you disappear for a week and they can't rely on you anymore, suddenly they appreciate what they have in you. So it's a game of learning that moment when you need to take a step back and not be so present.
Because just one more thing, if you don't mind, Alan. When you talked about the judge of the land, that he made himself of, he was like the person everybody went to because they felt that he was fair.
Yeah.
But when he made them build the city, and then even though he was right in the midst of the city, no one had access to actually get to him, and
right.
how that actually pushed him up to a level that made him even more bigger and more powerful, even
right.
though he was right in the midst of these people. So when you're using that concept,
mm-hmm.
how does that work in 2009, where nobody builds you a city no more? But I get the context of how it's going there. You know what I mean?
Well, it's more like if people come to value you for something, I deal with that a little bit. If I'm too available for people with my advice that I offer, and I do give advice and I do consult, and I don't look like I'm that special, anybody can have me. But if I make it so that that I'm there, that you can consult me if you want, and I can help you with your problems, and I do feel like I can help people with their problems, but it's hard to reach me. You have to go through some hoops. I'm not available all the time, and it might take several months before I can get back to you. It makes, it increases my value. It makes people think, that I have something that only one person has, and it's going to cost something to get it. So it's more like they know that you're there. They know that you have something valuable. That's what this man that you're talking about did, Dioses. People saw that he had something really valuable, but once they saw that, he made himself quite unavailable, so that people had to fight to get in front of him. I consider that an extremely powerful strategy in life, to make people come to you. Does that answer you?
That sure do. Thank you very much. And
oh,
Alan, thank you for once again having another powerful show.
Oh, thank you, Benny. That's Benny Randall. He has his own show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Check him out. Hey, we're running out of time, so listeners, I see a bunch of phone calls in the queue I can't take because we're coming down to like our last 7-8 minutes. This struck me in The Art of Seduction, Robert.
Yeah.
You said, use the demonic power of words to sow confusion.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
You probably hate that. That's probably your least favorite chapter. It's based on an idea that, we were talking earlier about the rake. And most of my book is sort of about just seduction in general. But occasionally I say that there are real differences between men and women. A man is really seduced by appearances. So a woman who dresses a certain way will just get his attention. And women have learned over the centuries how to use their appearance. A woman's weakness, however, is words. Women love words. They've always been seduced by a man who knows how to speak, well. It's almost not what a man says. It's the sound of the words themselves. And so if you a rake is generally someone who has a way with words. And I'm talking in there that it doesn't really necessarily matter exactly what you say, but it's how you say it. It's the tone of your voice. It's this kind of illusion, this fantasy that you're creating. And I give in that chapter all sorts of cues and tips on about how to use language in a way to seduce. Generally, my approach is that words are kind of a weak way of seduction, that what works is body language, something physical, kind of the nonverbal communication. But there is a power that words have, and it's generally a power that a man can wield over women.
Hmm. Okay. What's the difference between an aggressor and a passive aggressor?
Well, these are great questions, Alan. I'm saying in all of my books, this will be tying all of them together, that human beings have aggressive energy. That's our nature. That's who we are. We can't help it. And some people channel it in an obvious way. They're aggressive. And they're, I guess, straightforward and upfront. You know, sometimes they go a little too far with it, but that's who they are. Then there are people who just can't be like that, but they have that aggressive energy, and they become indirect and what we call passive-aggressive. And they use that energy in ways that are very tricky and extremely manipulative. And passive-aggressive people will just drive you crazy in life. They're just the worst, you know, because you never know what they're up to, what they're dealing with. They're masters at kind of playing on your emotions. They make you feel guilty all the time, even though they're the ones that are playing all these weird games. And so in all my books, I make a point of saying, I'm going to help you, reader, deal with the passive aggressors in life. I'm going to show you how they operate, what the tricks are, how they try and make you feel guilty, and how you have to fight them. Because you can't fight a passive aggressor with passive aggression. They're too good at it. They're going to beat you at that game. You have to be aggressive and upfront with a passive aggressor. And so, in the Power Book, in the War Book, and in the 50th Law, I lay it out there and help you how to deal with those kind of awful manipulative types.
Yeah, because see, in my book, I have four modes of behavior.
Yeah.
And I call my version of passive aggressive is a guy who vacillates between mode two and mode four.
Uh-huh.
Mode two would be the guy who tries to always be Mr. Nice Guy, Mr. Gentleman.
Yeah.
And then mode four is the angry misogynist.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Man, speaking of my book, this is a tradition I have on my show, so you're getting ready to get indoctrinated. My listeners and some colleagues took the title of my book and stretch out the O's. So instead of saying Mo 1, it's become this chant like, Mo 1. And I have all my guests do this, so now it's your turn. Robert Green, give me your best rendition of the Mo 1 chant.
Mo 1.
Mo 1. Alan Roger Curry.
Mo 1. Get up front and straightforward. Mo
1. Alan Roger Curry.
Now, since we
well, now, that was, mine wasn't so good. I'm hearing some; those are better. Wow. Anyway.
Since we're close to running out of time, I only got about one more question for you.
If
you can do this briefly, I'm hearing some static. Where is that coming from? Okay. What is the difference between mental flow, emotional flow, social flow, and cultural flow? You don't have to too detailed, but just in a nutshell, what was the gist of each of those?
Well, I'm talking in the 50th law about flow as an important way of being in this world so that you don't get too caught up in one way of doing things. And mental flow is where you're open to all sorts of different ideas in life. You don't hold on to one stupid idea that you learned when you were young and that's the only thing you know how to do. You're open to everything. Emotional flow is you don't let something that bad happen bother you. You let go of the bad stuff. You don't resent people, and you just let everything flow right through you. Social flow is the ability to mix with all different types of people in life, which I think is an important skill. I like to do that. I like to mix with every different kind of person that you find in America, from the top to the bottom. I don't find any differences, and I think it's what you need, a skill that you need in this world. And cultural flow is a lot of people in life, they get stuck on one era. You know, like I just turned 50, and a lot of people my age, they're kind of stuck in the 1980s, and that was their one era that they loved, and they still kind of dress that way. And you got to be like, you have to have flow with your culture. You have to keep up with the times. You don't want to be a relic, and you have to kind of keep adapting yourself and changing your style, and not just being this sort of relic from the past. So those are the four types of flow.
Okay, this would absolutely be my final question. Do you think it is possible to gain career success, financial success, and ultimately power without in any way, shape, or form being deceptive or manipulative?
Well, you know, I wish it were so, but I don't believe so. I really don't. I mean, I just think that if, as an adult, you realize that this is human nature. People are political. The main thing is that people have egos, and you have to. You can't go through life totally ignoring their egos. Sometimes you have to massage a person and deal with them in a political manner. And I don't think there's any instance where you're ever going to be, where you're not going to have to play that game. I don't even care if you're president of the United States. There's always somebody above you, and you're always having to. To at some moments seduce them or please them in some way. And my whole approach, I guess, is a little different. Is it's not such a bad thing. Just accept it. It's like it's part of being an adult, that this is part of the game. And the less you have in your life, the better, of course. But you're never going to get completely away from all the politicking and egos out there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, sir. It's been a discussion for sure. You've definitely laid out your theories and principles, and as expected, we bumped heads in certain areas. In other areas, I was stealing what you were saying. Could you let my listeners know? Well, go ahead.
No, I actually very interested to get a copy of your book. If you could send.
Oh,
it to me.
I'll hook you up with a copy of Mo 1 and Upfront and Straightforward, and. Yeah, and then you can provide me with your feedback. I definitely would respect your feedback. Tell my listeners where they can find you on the World Wide Web.
I have a website called powerseductionandwar.com. And, you know, I blog on there, and you can find all my books. And then The 50th Law, the new book, is available on Amazon.com and all the major bookstores, you know. And then I'm on Facebook if you want to find me.
Okay. Yeah, that's actually where I find you, on Facebook.
Yes.
I have to ask. I'm sorry if I keep saying this is the last question, but I got to ask you one more question.
Yes.
That this just struck me. I want to say this is an artist seduction.
Yes.
You endorse, I want to say, you can correct me if I'm wrong, you endorse the idea of just if you're in a relationship, just like breaking up with a woman just for the sake of breaking up with her. What's that about?
Where did you get that?
Okay, maybe I read it wrong, but it said that you should, in order to keep a woman, enhance her attraction to you, that you should kind of unexpectedly cause drama in the relationship or...
Well, it's all about what that gentleman before was talking about as far as absence and presence. And if you're always there for the woman, she starts taking you for granted. She just sees you as your easy prey. She'll get you your lunch money out of you, as you were talking about earlier. So sometimes you got to get the dynamic back on your side, and you got to maybe make it seem that there are other women that you're interested in. She's not the only one in your life. You got to get her to respect you more and not take you for granted. And if that means creating drama, if that means maybe looking at another woman or doing something like that, I have no problem with that.
We've run out of time. I have to let you know on the record, I don't agree with that at all. I know
you don't.
But I respect the fact that you have your opinions and you stick by them as, like I do with mine. But, hey, it's been a great conversation. Good luck with the 50th Law. Continued success to you. And thank you for joining me this evening. Listeners, again, I will not be around next week. Next week, I will not be on the air live. But I will be back in 2 weeks with a young lady named Ty Beauchamp. Until then, have an enjoyable, safe, productive weekend. I will see you in 2 weeks. I'm gonna call you on my cell.